At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A trillion here, a trillion there, what the White House has to say about the deficit. Forget GDP and check out the Genuine Progress Indicator on the broadcast today. Also, the rise of the mango. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FreshBooks, an online invoicing service for freelancers and small businesses designed to help save time, look professional, and make invoicing easy. More at FreshBooks.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at JaguarUSA.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's Monday today, the 19th of September. Great to have you with us. And we'll get to President Obama's deficit reduction plan in just a minute. But first, consider this. Not far behind the old saw of location, location, location in business is this. It pays to advertise, even when the economy is crummy, apparently. A report today from the good people at Nielsen shows that everybody from car makers to cell phone companies spent $53 billion on TV, radio, and print ads in the first half of the year. $53 billion in 6 months. That's up 5% from a year ago. And get this, after black eyes from the financial and foreclosure crises, bank ad spending was up 24% this year, trying to get us to sign up for credit cards and checking accounts. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Unemployment above 9%, a whipsawing stock market. In the middle of it all, banks spent $500 million advertising products like credit cards and another $500 million trying to convince customers to invest with them. Bart Narder analyzes banking products for Celent. He's noticed a couple of trends.
The stripped-down offer for customers who don't want the complexity.
The plain vanilla products.
City Simplicity offers unique benefits that address the frustration of late fees, penalty rate increases.
Maybe it's time to get back in the market, but different this time, with more control and more freedom.
The you can trust us approach. The other tactic, says Narder?
They're very rich rewards cards.
They'll match the miles you've earned on your airline credit card, up to 100,000.
The show me the money approach. Ron Shevlin is a banking products analyst with the Aite Group. He says banks are trying to shake their bad rap from the financial crisis.
So a lot of the ad spending now is driven on rebuilding their image and their reputations in the marketplace.
As for the rich rewards, Shevlin says with profits sliding, banks are battling it out over a small pool of wealthy, creditworthy customers. Bill Carroll is with Katz Television Group, which sells ad space.
When the economy is sluggish, you need to put a fire under the consumer, and the best way to do that is by advertising to them.
Carroll expects we'll continue to see ads about what's in your wallet through next year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
From Athens, Greece today, there was a glimmer of hope. The finance ministry said a deal on a continued bailout is near, whatever that means. What it means to Greeks that we spoke to in Athens today is pretty clear.
We have much less money than we had before, so we don't have many things to do anymore. We can't do anything, many things.
I don't go shopping very often for clothes and things I don't really, really need. I'm very careful with the price at the supermarket, that sort of stuff.
Everybody is anxious about how his life will be changed and expecting new regulations from the government. Everybody's unsure about what's going to happen next.
We are about 2 years thinking and talking about what we have to do, how we have to do. Nobody has done nothing up to now.
It's not the politicians, it's we who vote for them, and our way of thinking is wrong. The nowadays Greek way of thinking is the enemy for me.
That was Deep Breath here. Andreas Nazaritis, Aspakokino Juli, Panagiotis Panagiotou, Dimitris Giozelis, and Yorgos Tsaitis in Athens, Greece today. You didn't think I was going to make that, did you? On Wall Street this Monday, a climb back from the brink. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. An interesting thing happened on the way to the opening bell this morning. Reed Hastings, the CEO and founder of the online video service Netflix, issued what amounted to about a half an apology. Netflix stock has been getting clobbered lately, down another 7% or so today, after a series of price increases and service changes. Hundreds of thousands of people, by some counts an even million, have canceled their subscriptions. So today, Hastings sort of apologized and tried to explain why. And, oh, by the way, announced he's going to split off the DVD-by-mail business that made Netflix famous. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Netflix CEO Reed Hastings posted a YouTube video this morning along with his half apology.
We're making this video today to apologize in person, or at least on camera, for something that we did recently.
Hastings is referring to Netflix's decision to separate DVD rentals and streaming. The net effect, for many, was that prices jumped dramatically. But instead of lowering prices today, Hastings announced a separate website called Quixter for DVD rentals. Now consumers who want to watch their movies online and rent DVDs need to go to two websites and pay two bills. This didn't please them, and it didn't please Hastings' other audience today, Wall Street. James McQuivey is a tech analyst at Forrester Research.
There's no reason that he would have gone out publicly like this with a sort of mea culpa had he not been hoping that Wall Street would hear the real message, which is, look, the cost of supporting the DVD business is going to get to a point where we don't even want to do it.
Wall Street sent Netflix stock through the roof last year when its online streaming business seemed poised to take on the cable industry. But today, Netflix is struggling to maintain its online offerings, much less expand them, and it's losing subscribers whose fees could pay for the additional content Netflix needs. Analysts like Tony Weibel at Janney Montgomery Scott say this could easily become a downward spiral.
Where you could have less content, which gets you fewer subs, which equals less content.
Which is why Weibel says Reed Hastings' split strategy may have made things twice as bad. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
It was once more into the Rose Garden for President Obama this morning for his big deficit announcement. $3 trillion or so out of the deficit over the next 10 years. Another $1.5 trillion in new taxes, targeting mostly the rich. At which point, a note must be made of the political realities behind the proposed policies. Republicans say they're a non-starter. But we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to do the due diligence all the same.
President Obama wants to apply what's become known as the Buffett rule. Tax people like billionaire Warren Buffett a lot more, something Buffett himself proposed. The president says everyone, including millionaires and billionaires, has to pay their fair share.
This is not class warfare. It's math.
Okay, Mr. President, let's do the numbers. Well, we really can't. 3 of every 1,000 taxpayers are millionaires. But the president doesn't say exactly how much more they would pay in taxes. The Buffett rule doesn't lay out a minimum tax rate for Buffett and his buddies. The president just says the rule is a guiding principle. Robertson Williams is an economist with the Tax Policy Center. Asked to grade the president's math, Williams gives him an incomplete.
And the reason he gets an incomplete is he hasn't completed the answer. He has the outlines of an answer, but not the details necessary to determine exactly what he's saying.
The president did say clearly that he would end the Bush tax cuts for families making more than $250,000 a year. That would bring in $800 billion of the president's proposed $1.5 trillion in new taxes. Maya McGinnis heads the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The bulk of his new taxes come from letting those Bush tax cuts expire.
Now, keep in mind, that's actually already the current law.
McGinnis says the president has to go way beyond that and change the tax code. Warren Buffett has complained that he's taxed at a lower rate than his secretary. That's because he makes most of his money from investments, only taxed at 15%. So if we raise the tax rate on investment earnings to, say, 25%, would that fill in our budget hole? Nope, according to Robertson Williams.
Bottom line, though, is there's not that much income at the top end to solve our budget problems. We'd have to raise rates very high on high-income folks, and it's unlikely that's going to happen.
That leaves the rest of us who aren't millionaires. Williams and McGinnis say we might have to give up some of our favorite tax deductions, something the president left out today. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's not much joy in economic statisticsville right at the moment. You want to get the press, take a peek at the jobs numbers, as you know, or the gross domestic product report. But maybe we're measuring the wrong thing. I mean, when you spot a friend passing by, do you say, hey, how's your GDP? Yeah, no, my guess is you probably go with, how you doing? The state of Maryland is working on a way to figure out how people are doing by tracking stuff that GDP misses. Our series, Economy 4.0, is all about how to make the global economy work better for more people. So today, Marketplace's David Brancaccio reports on the Maryland Genuine Progress Indicator.
Question: how much is it worth to play baseball with your kids? Or maybe play guitar with some friends? Not to be crass, but I'm looking for a dollar figure.
We always say, what would you rather have, more money or more time? And I bet you people will always say, more time.
Matt Ossenmacher lives with his wife Lisa and 8-year-old son in Silver Spring, Maryland. He's a master carpenter who restores historic houses scattered clear around the Washington Beltway. So his commute can stretch from an hour and a half to 3 hours a day. This chops away at the little leisure time that he could otherwise spend playing guitar.
Dad, not like that.
That's him with his son Eli on bongos. Once upon a time, Matt used to play guitar in a Cajun band.
I used to play a lot more.
What happened? Why not play more?
There's no time. You know, you want to do everything, and you end up not doing very much.
He and a lot of other Americans. And this loss of leisure is typically not accounted for when the economy is assessed. It just comes out of our collective hides. But in Maryland, a dollar estimate is being calculated. One piece of the state's wider assessment of well-being called the Maryland Genuine Progress Indicator. Frank Skinner at the Maryland Department of Labor says when it comes to lost leisure time, some things really were better back in the old days.
With 1969 being the year that the United States had the most leisure time per capita, and from that we subtract the amount of leisure time lost, and then we multiply that by the median wage.
And here it is, the value of all Marylanders' lost leisure time.
Between $11.5 and $12.5 billion per year.
That's a big number, very close to all Maryland collects in taxes and fees annually. And the Genuine Progress Indicator doesn't stop there. It measures 25 other things, from the cost of cleaning up pollution to the cost of divorces and crime to the value of volunteer work.
What they attempt to do is to quantify and measure whether we are or whether we are not safeguarding the precious resources that define our quality of life.
That's Maryland's Governor Martin O'Malley. He's a Democrat who says he's all about economic growth, but thinks policymakers have to subtract the kind of growth that's bad for people while still measuring the kind that's good.
You don't want to just count jobs?
Well, jobs are important. Jobs are critically important. But all of those new ways of doing things create a tremendous amount of jobs and tremendous economic growth.
And while there are benefits to being governor, leisure time is not one.
You used to be quite a guitar player, I understand.
I was. There was nothing leisurely about the way I played guitar.
You still doing much of that?
Every now and again.
Why not do it more?
Hard to schedule.
He's been known to front a Celtic folk rock band called O'Malley's March, more so in his pre-governor days. And here's what the indicators for Maryland are showing, beyond all the time for fun and family getting sucked away. While traditional GDP-style calculations of economic growth in the state have been trending ever upward over the years, like the waistlines of beer drinkers in a honky-tonk, well-being in Maryland has been stuck in place for 3 decades now. This pattern that well-being does not go hand-in-hand with GDP growth is echoed in other states that use alternative measures, including Minnesota, Ohio, and Utah. In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Just getting people to think about mangoes is kind of a huge thing. Getting people to even recognize what it is.
Marketing mangoes. But first, let's do the numbers. Worries over European debt ruled the day. Today, the Dow Industrials ended down 108 points, nearly 1%, closed at 11,401. The Dow was at one point down more than 200 points until word came, as I mentioned earlier, that they are close to some kind of agreement. The NASDAQ deleted 9 points, about a third percent, finished at 2612. The S&P 500 off 11 points, 1%, wrapped up at 1204. Analysts gave the life insurance industry a little discouraging diagnosis today. MetLife skipped down 4.75%. Principal Financial Group and Lincoln National each unplugged around 3.5% today. Morgan Stanley fell almost 8%. Citigroup unloaded a little more than 4%. Bank of America and UBS each down more than 3% today. Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, and JP Morgan Chase each took off more than 2%. Britain's FTSE and Germany's DAX each dropped more than 2%. The French CAC 40, the CAC 40, dropped 3%. I like to trot out the French every now and then. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect. And by Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. For the latest business news, go to Marketplace.org and click on the Newsletters tab to get business and economic news delivered to you daily, right now to your inbox. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for August. The Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. And what is the real debt limit? On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee addresses that question. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Just because there aren't enough macroeconomic policy discussions happening right now in Washington, D.C., there's this on the agenda for this coming weekend, a meeting of the world's 20 largest developed and developing economies, the G20, as it's known. Also, annual meetings of both the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Robert Zoellick is the president of the World Bank. Mr. Zoellick, good to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
You gave some, I wouldn't say harsh, but I would say fairly pointed remarks this morning about what the developed economies need to do, the United States, Europe, and Japan, to get this crisis solved. Is it your sense that anybody's listening?
Oh, sure. Our people are very aware of the nature of these problems, but we're starting to see some contagion to developing countries. And prior to August, the developing countries had been providing about a half of global growth. So if this expands to developing countries, it's going to push the whole world system into more difficult straits.
Well, let me ask you about that, because we were talking the other day on the broadcast about the BRIC countries, Brazil and India and China specifically, actually volunteering to help out with the European mess and maybe buy some bonds and do what they can. What is the World Bank's role as developing countries start helping out the developed world?
Well, the developing countries are helping out the developed world simply by growing and having good economic policies. And that flows through with trade effects. For example, their investments in infrastructure use a lot of U.S. and developed world equipment. On this idea of a bailout by developing countries, frankly, I think that's been oversold. The developed world's going to have to solve the developed world's problems.
The Europeans are going to have to solve the European problems, and we're going to have to solve ours?
That sounds the way most problems get solved, doesn't it?
Yes, but there's this whole globally interconnected economy that we keep talking about.
Well, look, let's take the Eurozone. The Eurozone up to now has been putting financing in to try to help countries that can't sell their debt, to try to support the banking system. That is very important, but it fundamentally buys time. What the Eurozone is going to have to do is deal with the interconnected problems of sovereign debt, and then for some countries, their overall competitiveness. Now, what this means is that when the European Monetary Union was formed some 20 years ago, people left off a piece, the idea of whether they would have a complementary fiscal union. Now, these are decisions that only Europeans can make. They're very political. But my message is we're coming to a crunch point here, and they're going to have to decide whether they're going to create a complementary fiscal union, or they're going to have to prepare to deal with the consequences for members that are uncompetitive and have too much debt. The United States is also going to have to deal with not necessarily cutting entitlements, but slowing the rate of growth of entitlements.
I appreciate your message, but do you believe there's a political will either in the European capitals or in Washington, D.C. to make these incredibly difficult choices?
Well, I know there's always the suspicion that democracies can't decide. You know, I worked on German unification in 1989-90. Mm. That was a rather big issue, and the Germans stepped up. So I really do think this is a question of leadership, and I happen to believe, having been involved with policy as well as politics, that at moments like this, the bold decision can also be good politics.
Let me ask you about another thing the World Bank was out with today, a policy paper showing that we're not doing enough to get women advanced in the global economy, and in fact, it's a great detriment to solving a lot of the development problems we have in this economy. Why is it that we can never recognize the contribution that women make economically and make decent policies about that?
Well, we hope this report that we've just released will help change that, because it shows in very practical terms how, if you simply change some of the rules, some of the inhibitions, allow women to own property, have access to inputs in agriculture in Africa, that you can increase productivity very significantly. So the basic logic starts out that if you're a country that wants to grow and you want to get the full benefit of your public, you can't ignore 50% of your population.
Is this the moment, with the global economy facing so many other troubles, to try to raise this point? Are you worried it might be sort of lost in the rush of bad news?
There's always the risk that the imminent news story drives this out. But the reason I think this is actually timely is we're looking for sources of growth. And giving women an opportunity to reach their full potential, allowing them to move into engineering jobs. Most of the agricultural workers in sub-Saharan Africa are women. So why not give them the access to the credit and the inputs? This can help economies.
Robert Zoellick is the president of the World Bank. Annual meetings coming up this weekend. Mr. Zoellick, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you.
There's news of a tentative deal here in Southern California that's going to avoid a strike at three major supermarket chains. It's going to keep more than 60,000 workers on the job and stores open. Next time you happen to be in a grocery store, by the way, take a swing by the produce section. Find the mangoes, give one a squeeze, take it home if you so choose, and ask yourself this. Mangoes? Have they always been here? Lisa Matuska has more.
Let's start with the banana. In the early 1900s, the United Fruit Company transformed the banana. The company, now known as Chiquita, managed to turn this exotic yellow fruit into an international commodity with the help of railroads, politics, and marketing.
If a banana isn't 9 inches, it's garbage as far as Del Monte and Dole and all those big Chiquita, all those big companies. That's their standard. Now, that's really almost unnatural among bananas. They usually are smaller.
Chris Rollins is director of the Fruit and Spice Park in Homestead, Florida. He grows about 100 varieties of bananas in his park, and he says it was only a few years ago that banana companies finally introduced a normal-sized banana.
And then the marketing was really funny because they implied that it was a genetic breakthrough. They called it the lunchbox banana. And in fact, it was what bananas are.
Now let's look at the mango. Its transformation began here, near Miami, at the Fairchild Botanical Gardens. In the 1950s and 1960s, researchers brought in mangoes from around the world. They crossbred the mangoes to develop new varieties.
They selected things that had red color, that had disease resistance, that shipped well. They could send them to New York and get money for them, things like that. These were new ideas for mangoes.
Richard Campbell is a researcher at the gardens. And until the early 90s, most of the country's mangoes were grown in Florida. But in 1992, Hurricane Andrew destroyed most of the state's mango groves. In 1994, NAFTA was passed, which opened the floodgates for mango imports.
And we started bringing in mangoes from Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Brazil, and they were all our mangoes. They were all Florida varieties grown with Florida technology.
And now we get mangoes in grocery stores like this, all across the U.S., all year round. But the fruit still has a long way to go in terms of a commodity. Fresh mangoes are still a little bit intimidating. Consumers like Gail Miller are comfortable buying things like mango salsa or mango-flavored juice, but...
Never bought a mango at a grocery store.
Never did. Wouldn't know what to do with it. No, I just peaches and the normal stuff.
This is where Wendy McManus comes in. She's the director of marketing at the National Mango Board in Orlando.
It's more of an impulse item. So that's one of the big things that we try to work on. Just getting people to think about mangoes is kind of a huge thing. Getting people to even recognize what it is.
The Mango Board was formed in 2005 after a group of importers in Arizona decided that the mango should be the next big thing among fruit commodities. McManus says one of her major job duties is simply showing people how to cut a mango.
Some people call it the hedgehog. It's where you cut off the cheek and you score both directions in a diamond pattern, and then you turn the mango inside out. You sort of pop it out so the cubes are all sort of spiking out like a hedgehog.
If the hedgehog method is too confusing, she recommends just scooping it out with a spoon. But is that spoonful of mango tasty?
We get a mango that's pretty, it travels well, but doesn't necessarily taste good.
Researcher Richard Campbell says that's about to change. He says consumers are demanding new tastes outside the generic. Take, for example, Indian mangoes.
They are absolutely some of the most heavenly flavors on the planet. But an Indian mango can insult somebody. It can be so strong that if you're not ready for it, it can really wake you up.
And Campbell says this wake-up call is what's next for mangoes. He's talked with people from Costco, Walmart, and Chiquita about branching out into new varieties. His team in South Florida has just patented their own variety that they hope to unleash on the market. It's called the Coconut Cream Mango. For Marketplace, I'm Lisa Matuska.
Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. By Constant Contact, combining email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on the clock. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation about ketchup and hamburgers and the slow pace of change. First of all, ketchup. The Wall Street Journal had a big story this morning about Heinz and its new easy-to-use single-serve ketchup package that the company spent 3 years developing. And Wendy's, we learned today, courtesy of the Associated Press, spent 2.5 years coming up with their new Dave's Hot and Juicy Hamburger. Which brings me to this. Whatever happened to just a plain old burger and fries? I mean, I think that's a fair question. All right, that's it. Ponder that. We got to go. It's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow ended down 108 points, nearly 1%. The NASDAQ erased 9 points, about a third percent. The S&P 500 fell 11 points, 1% on that particular index. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, Don't Ask, Don't Tell ends tomorrow. But for discharged gays and lesbians, getting back into the military isn't going to be all that easy.
The retention across the military is high. The Marine Corps has a waiting list to get in.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.